Welcome back, friends.
Welcome back.
So I'm very excited for this episode, mainly because it's extension. I don't know if that's the right word, of an episode we did live.
Oh, yeah.
Right. So we can get into it a little bit more.
Absolutely. And I'm also really enjoying this bi-weekly format. It just feels like we can just converse more in real time, which is exciting.
Absolutely. So topic today, best and worst advice through the decades.
Whew. Yeah. And there have definitely been some doozies.
So you obviously wrote this question. Something that you've done recently that scares you.
Yeah. So I...
Or that scared you.
Yeah. Well, I drove ATVs in Santorini and in Mykonos, a four-wheeler in Mykonos and a buggy in Santorini, and I was all about it.
You weren't scared that it was going to flip over or anything?
No, I don't think, and this is probably like slightly problematic, but it's what makes people like me tick. We don't think of the consequences. So death wasn't something that actually occurred to me as the rolling cliff was. And at first I was riding with someone else and I was like, do you mind if we just go a little bit faster?
I would have been like,
I was like, I'm not Miss Daisy. And so finally she trusted me enough to let me drive.
And you're like,
and so we had a caravan and I was like, how fast do y'all want to go? It was like real fast. We said, girl, whip that joint. It was so much fun.
Did you have a guide?
No.
Okay, so it was a path and you knew where you were going.
Yeah, thankfully, GPS worked. And so, you know, whoever was not driving, they were responsible for the GPS. But also, when we speak about Santorini and Mykonos, I mean, Santorini more so than Mykonos, you can't really get lost. Just kind of go in a loop and you'll get back to your destination.
You can go all the way around the island?
Almost completely.
Oh, wow. Yeah. I didn't realize it was that small.
And in Santorini, we went from... where we were down in kind of like Santorini city center up to, and I forgot the name of that, but up to Ia, which is where all of like the Blue Dome churches are. And we stopped at a winery and it was just lovely. Went to Parisa, the Black Sand Beach. Okay. None of that would have been the same for me if we had been in a car. So I'm
totally
happy I did it.
Were you ever close to Ikaria in Greece?
In Greece? But where is that at? On mainland? Like, near Athens?
I don't know. It's a blue zone.
Oh, well, this is where all the people live forever. Mm. Oh, I gotta go there. That sounds like Narnia. Mm-hmm. I bet you it's in probably one of the, if it is on one of the islands, it's one of the like more less populated
ones.
Yeah,
it's not on a tourist. It's not touristy.
Yeah, because I want to go back and I cannot wait. I really want to go to Paros, which is where like all the Greeks go for vacation.
Oh.
And I want to go to Crete, which I hear is absolutely beautiful.
Yeah, I would too.
What about you?
I reject this question.
What, Margot?
I reject this question.
You can't reject a... Who says that? I reject a question.
Next. Subsequent. Okay, so there's a little background. When I saw that you wrote this question down, I was like, I reject this question because I feel like, on the one hand, I do things every day that scare me and I... and or let me put this differently. I feel like... there's nothing really that could scare me anymore. Mm-hmm.
Talk about it.
And I don't get off on getting scared. So, like, I think there are people who like to do scary things because it gives them a jolt of adrenaline. Mm-hmm. Or, like, I think you're one of those people. My husband's one of those people, right? He likes, like...
Mountain biking
by himself, surfing in the winter, ski jumping, right? Like, stuff that inherently is risky. I don't need that. I feel like life is scary enough. I've had to make a lot of scary decisions, and I've been confronted with scary situations. I don't need it. Also, I used to have this exercise teacher who used to say, you need to do something every day that scares you. And I would say, no, you don't, because life is scary. Why do you need to scare yourself?
This just sounds really boring, Margot, and I don't receive any of this. I think even the small things that you've done take credit. And it doesn't mean that you've had to go out and seek it, even if it came to you. I can think of one decision that you made recently that probably was scary, but you made that fucking decision.
Right. But like okay, so it's not something that scared you that you enjoyed.
Mm-mm.
Okay. So like dying of cancer. So I didn't want to die of cancer, so I had preventative surgery a couple weeks ago, and that was scary.
Okay.
And confronting my mortality is scary.
Yeah, I mean, your decision to have all of these prophylactic procedures, a lot of people would not have done because they would have had to confront it.
Right, so that they were scary, but they were also... So that's what I mean. Like, I feel like I make scary decisions, and...
Yeah, I just happen to think that we should get credit for those things. It doesn't mean that we're thrill-seeking.
Okay, so maybe that's a different... Also, I think you and I would disagree about, like, what's thrill-seeking. So I would go do, like, an exercise class in 105 degrees and, like, leave, like, dripping wet and feel exhilarated. And you'd be like, why did you make me die and come back to life? Right,
like, why do I want to be hot?
Right.
Yeah.
And so... There are some, like, physical things that I do to myself that others would say are scary that I don't find scary.
So it's just about self-inquiry.
But I would be terrified to 18. I don't think I would have gone.
Really?
I would have met you at the winery.
I'm going to Uber. I'll see you there.
Or I would have walked or something. Okay. Like, it's not the activity. Like, I love activities. I just, as I've gotten older, don't want to hurt myself.
Yeah. No, and that's real.
And that sometimes prevents me from enjoying myself. And I don't want to be a drag to other people.
Okay. That's real. But I mean, you also did have a very real accident in Belize. So, but I mean, that wasn't you thrill seeking. You were just sitting on a hammock. But still, these things happen.
So you were totally safe, like careening off a mountain in Santorini. And I broke my back on a
sitting on a hammock.
On my last vacation. So cheers to that. Okay. Wow. And again, Tashira's the more fun person in this relationship.
I'm talking about that.
So dumb shit, people say. This one is good. And something that we've talked about before.
Yeah.
I believe we did a live on this a couple years ago.
So for folks who do not know, the Megan Thee Stallion and Tory Lanez documentary has, like, just hit the streets, hot off the presses. I think there are two episodes at the time of us filming available on Max or on HBO. And some of these facts I think we all kind of knew, but the documentary does a really good job of digging deeper. They have transcripts from trial. They have gone back and I'm sure FOIA'd, like, the 911 calls and the interviews with police post-arrest. And so... they've dug pretty deep. And the first episode was kind of pro-Megan. And the second episode has been pro-Tory, which I thought was a very interesting kind of take.
I also think it's important because for those of us who are not lawyers, so for lawyers, I think this is something that feels very familiar to us, right? Seeing things from both sides and doing your due diligence on both sides. I think for people who maybe didn't go to law school or are not interested in criminal proceedings, in this way,
yeah,
this might be like the first time they've ever dug into a criminal case like this.
Yeah. And for folks who don't know, let me just say, Megan Thee Stallion is a Grammy Award winning rapper. I think that Megan's, like, range and her ability to, like, spit bar for bar, she's one of the greatest rappers of all time. Just, like, I'm gonna go out there and I'm just gonna say it. And I think rappers have noticed her and her talent. Okay. And so that has made her a superstar. And when this all happened, I think the dumb shit people say, or the dumb shit men say specifically, is about people like Joe Budden and 50 Cent, who post-trial, and by the way, Tory Lanez was accused of shooting Megan Thee Stallion in the foot and subsequently faced trial and is now serving a 10-year prison sentence for
Convicted.
And it wasn't just shooting her. It was also possessing an unregistered firearm and a few other charges, right? So, before this, he was out on bail and had a lot to say on social media. And he began to rile up, or, you know, black men decided it was their responsibility to come out and to support him. And Joe Budden had some very, like, disgusting things to say about her, even criticizing her mental health. Megan said on trial that if she had known what she was going to face, the backlash, she wishes that Tory Lanez had just killed her. 50 Cent also posted things demeaning Megan, etc. And what they have since done is backpedaled and apologized. And so you can recognize the apology, But Margot, I think there's something to be said about how we frame victims of abuse in this society. And also, I should say that a lot of the scrutiny that Megan has received has been because she's not the quote unquote perfect victim, because she did have a sexual relationship with Tory Lanez, as did her assistant. And that has made all of this a lot more murky in some people's eyes. But we know as attorneys, the victim isn't the one that's on trial, right? So his actions of now being convicted of shooting her don't have anything to do with who she was sleeping with and who she was not.
Or whether she was sleeping with him or not. Or whether she was sleeping with him and not sharing that with her friend, or they were sleeping with him together. It's actually irrelevant.
100%. But we see this often.
Mm-hmm. We do. And I'm struck by something you said. I thought you were going to say something different. So I thought you were going to say, Megan reported back after the trial that if she had known how gruesome the trial and the backlash were going to be, that she would never have reported the incident or engaged in the criminal process.
Yeah.
Which is bad enough, yeah. Right? But what you said was she wishes that he had killed her.
Because dealing with all of the criticism and the vitriol online.
And I imagine there's a lot there, too, that she's not sharing about risk to her personal safety, that reporting and engaging in the criminal process.
And I just, my heart broke for her in this documentary as well, because can you imagine going through probably what is one of the most horrific times of your life? Your mom has passed away. Your dad has passed away. Your grandmother who helped to raise you has passed away. Who is holding you in this very difficult time?
And the person with whom you were probably, you were having some sort of intimate relationship with just shot you, and your best friend assistant is also sleeping with that person. So like, what's your really, I mean, your relationship can't be great either. So it you're is. Really alone.
Yeah.
I think, yeah, my heart continues to break for her, because what we know is that, yeah, he's in jail now, which I don't know if that's good or bad, but he can't harm her physically. He can't, but like his people can, the community can, the interwebs can.
Mm-hmm.
And she has had to endure all of that shaming about her behavior when she was the one who was shot in the foot.
And she didn't shoot herself. So I think my thing is, there's this camp that wants to believe that her assistant slash former best friend shot her. Even if that's true, she's still a victim. And there is this rampant massage noir that, unfortunately, very many Black people perpetuate against Black women. Because something struck me where, you know, all these celebrities and then Tory's kind of party line starts to become, I'm a Black man and I'm being victimized by the criminal justice system and this is a miscarriage of justice. And it's like, this is a Black woman. So how then does that play out? And then I'm reminded that Megan didn't even tell the truth about what happened initially, because she was afraid for all of their safety, including his, because this was after George Floyd.
Right, it was post George Floyd.
So it's like, who is protecting women? Who is protecting Black
women? Say it louder.
Women.
No one. No one. Because arguably Black women in American US society are the least protected of all, because they're protecting Black men who have disproportionately been negatively impacted by law enforcement in the criminal justice system. And in so doing, they are not protected. And if they engage in the criminal justice system, they are alleged to be perpetrators of violence against Black men, even though they were victimized by violence potentially at the hands of Black men.
Because you can't snitch. But how does that even apply when you were the one that was victimized, when you were the one that was shot?
And if you can't report, how do you attain safety? So arguably Megan had resources, has a bodyguard, had a career, like did not deal with a lot of the social insecurity that a lot of people who reach out to law enforcement do, right? She probably had stable housing. She had food. She had someone driving her. They were had been partying at Kendall and Kylie Jenner's house.
Don't get me started on that.
All right. So there's something else there.
And also, like, how did the Jenner Kardashians evade being subpoenaed? Like, Kylie was there. Why was she
Isn't
not
she underage? Oh, I guess not anymore.
Not anymore. But yeah, because a lot of people, I think all sides say that this started because Tory was flirting with Kylie. And I'm like, these fucking... I am not blaming Kylie Jenner. Clearly, this is not her fault. She did not shoot Megan Thee Stallion. But stay away from these people. Just stay away from them. God damn it. Like, I just, it's not safe when a Jenner enters the chat.
Okay, so here's the other thing, other than that. Why is the conversation even around questioning Megan?
Always. Always.
And like, look, innocent until proven guilty. Being charged with a crime is a big deal. Being convicted of a crime really has a negative impact on your life.
Yeah.
Our criminal justice system historically has made a lot of errors. Carceral systems are not restorative. They're not meant to be restorative. And why is the focus on her?
No one. Arguably, between all three of these people, she had the most to lose. And yet we're here. So again, thankfully, hopefully 50 Cent and Joe Budden are seeing the error of their ways. I doubt it because they are known social media trolls. And
like, again, why are they experts on this case where they weren't there? They're not law enforcement. They're not defense attorneys. They're not reading the police reports. They're just talking about how they feel about someone who's in the same industry as them. And they're not nice.
And they're not nice. So therefore...
Or they've done things that they don't agree with, which means nothing because.
It's wild to me, that entire line of thinking, because what they will never admit and people like it is that they are dealing with a lot of massage noir, a lot of internalized sexism. And I don't think they have the language and possibly not even the intellectual rigor or self-awareness to be able to name that.
So one of the things we're going to link in the show notes, because I think it is so powerful, and I would like to also talk about it more in our private community, is this op-ed that Megan Thee Stallion wrote for the Washington Post about what it means to be a Black female or female-presenting victim of domestic violence or intimate partner violence in this country.
Yeah.
Because it was so – and I don't know if she wrote it or she wrote it with someone else. It doesn't really matter. Yeah. She wrote about her own experiences, but this idea of – you know, damned if you do, damned if you don't. Absolutely. And are we really saying that people don't deserve a life free from violence or being shot?
Because nothing justifies that.
No, so bad behavior doesn't justify it.
Mm-mm. No, no side of the story that other people have told that were in the car, whether it be Tory or her former best friend, justifies her being shot. And I hate to be the one to say this because I usually don't like to use this phrase, but how we turn on each other, you know, how women in general.
So I didn't want to say it. I didn't. Well, I can't speak to that, but just how I think we have been socialized to turn so quickly on each other, meaning women turning on women.
Yep.
And it actually should be the exact opposite. Like, no one's coming for us to save us.
But sometimes I think that our material conditions can be so dire until it just makes us make irrational fucking decisions. So I'm like, how much money do they offer her? That was my first thought. I don't know, but that was my first thought.
Yeah. So it's so interesting that that was your first thought. Do you know what my first thought was?
What?
That she was threatened.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that she's not safe. Either.
Wow.
And that if she had testified to what she actually experienced or saw.
Yeah. I don't know. I just wish none of this would have ever happened. Someone in the documentary likened this to this generation's O.J. Simpson trial, which I was like, really? But evidently, I mean, it controlled much of the discourse on social media for a very long time.
And we're so quick to turn on people in power,
mm-hmm.
right? Because so you know, it's this idea that like once you get what you've been working for, you're going to be canceled.
Mm. Which is always like a threat that is looming.
Right. Really, and it's like it's a product of success in this new marketplace that people are coming for you. But it just makes me think like, are we all the WWE? Right. Like, are we all just like, come at me anyway, because that's what it takes. And like, you just take people down. And like Megan Thee Stallion, like, why take her down? She was fucking shot.
Here's my thing that I also do not like. People often say, well, celebrities signed up for it. That's what they get.
They did not
sign. They did fucking not.
They did not sign up for it. They signed up to be an artist.
They didn't sign up to receive death threats, to be trolled on the internet, to be doxxed for their address to be
shared widely, to have a bodyguard with you. How do you even have a private life? I keep thinking about Taylor Swift and her new boyfriend. Like, how do you even date?
Girl, don't even get me started on that. That's all for publicity, but we're now
going off the... No, it's not. They like each other.
Oh, okay. It's genuine, Margot. Okay. They just...
We have to ask our resident expert, but...
Totally not calling paparazzi and telling them where they're going to be.
They're absolutely not. You think they are?
I think all of it is constructed.
Okay, best and worst advice, teenage years.
Teenage years. So I also want to say the advice that I did not listen to.
Right, but that could be the best advice.
Exactly. Because there are, you know, times where I just made questionable decisions. And so...
Same.
The best advice I did not listen to was that I should go to an HBCU. I think that I really struggled when I was a teenager to, like, obviously I knew I was Black and I accepted that part of my identity, but I'd also been like in this kind of rigorous academic program. I was an international baccalaureate student and I had been convinced that the good schools were PWIs because that's where all of my white peers and others were going. And so I regret that to this day. Everything happens for a reason. I don't know what my time at like a FAMU or in Hampton or in a Howard would have been like. But I think that it would have really been a phenomenal experience. I don't even think I knew Howard existed. But if I had gone to like a premier HBCU, I think that I would have had kind of like a eye-opening experience earlier.
I can see that.
Maybe found myself a little bit sooner. The advice that I did listen to was to major in English in undergrad. And I remember this man's face to this day.
Who told you to major in English?
It was this guy, an older gentleman, mustache, beard, kind of like a little slight fro, at an HBCU college fair that I went to. That's why things like that for students like me were really important, because I did like lack exposure. I didn't know any attorneys until I went to law school. And so we went to a college fair. I was part of this program called MAPS, Minority Achievement Program. And I remember speaking to a college counselor. I don't even remember the school, telling him I wanted to be an attorney. And he said, oh, you should major in English. And I had never heard that, never thought of it. And I was like, well, why? He said, because you're going to learn a lot of analytical skills that are going to be important. And I think had I not known that, I probably would have majored in like criminal justice and hated it. Like I had no idea how to become an attorney. Nobody could advise me. Mm-hmm. And you all, this was like the early days of the internet. I mean, these days, Mari is probably Googling things, right? Everybody has a wealth of information at their fingertips. That there was a time, I know it's hard for the young people to believe, that was not true. Totally. So you couldn't just Google, how do you become an attorney? Mm-hmm. And so that advice changed my life. I think it really helped me to stay the course, because I really, really enjoyed majoring in that in undergrad.
Okay, great.
What about you?
I think the worst advice I got in my teens was that my worth as a human was related to my achievements, and achievements in particular ways. So this isn't going to surprise people who've listened to the podcast before, right? But that unless I achieved academically in a certain way, or in, I was a pretty committed dancer. I had a lot of responsibility in my household at that time with my baby brother. Like, if I didn't achieve in these ways that were set out for me, I wasn't going to be a worthwhile human. Mm-hmm. But what that, what I lost in that messaging was like what I needed to make myself happy and whole. Because I didn't figure that out till much later. Some good advice that I was given in my teens was to be careful about social, like, parties and stuff that were happening around me. I probably internalized this too much, but there were a lot of people at my school who got in a lot of trouble and were pretty harmed, both physically from being overly intoxicated or overdoses or sexual assaults, that I was like very aware of, and I never kind of was subject to that, even though I knew it was happening.
Yeah. And let me just say, you went to like this elite school where it was a boarding school, but you were a day student. So I'm sure students with a lot of money were around you, and where there's money with young kids.
I was like, right. So I was a day student. I was a local kid. I had a much younger brother who I had a lot of responsibility for, but there were a lot of boarding students who were from New York and LA, some who had apartments in Boston. I mean, like, crazy stuff that I couldn't even, like, now when I think about it, I'm like, that is so crazy that they kept a car when they, like, before they had a license and they didn't live in the place, you know, like, yeah. Stuff like that. But really dangerous stuff that now kind of, at the time I knew, and I just was not interested in participating.
Yeah.
And I think at the time I thought like, oh, it's because, you have to take care of your brother, or you're like a dork, or you're not invited. And actually, in retrospect, I'm really grateful that I just wasn't interested in participating in that behavior.
Yeah, I wasn't with the shits either. I mean, yeah. I wasn't with the shits because I knew, I think partly intuitively, but maybe also because of the messaging around me, that academics were going to be the way that I made it out of my circumstances.
And I knew that too. I mean, like, in a different way, but I knew that I didn't want to live in the town that I grew up. I knew that I hoped that there was life outside of the part of the region that I was living in, mm-hmm. and I knew that the only way out was going to be through academics as well.
Yeah.
Okay, 20s. This is what I'm interested in, because I don't know what you're going to say.
So, 20s, I actually shared this during our live taping. I remember having a really horrific experience or experiences at work. And I was coming home, and at this point I was kind of living with my boyfriend at the time, but not really. I was like 22, 23 years old. I'd moved to the Atlanta suburbs to be near my mom, with my mom, but I was bored out of my mind. I was not being challenged. So I was living with him mostly during the week. Setting the stage, because I finally get a job at a law firm in downtown Atlanta. I've been fighting for this for a long time. Hadn't really had a stable job or income post law school or post undergrad, and I really needed this job. So I get this job, and it is a white male owned and operated firm. All three partners were white men, and one of them in particular was sexually harassing me, something terrible. I mean, all out, but like inviting me to suck his dick tight. Although I use that example purposely, because I remember sitting at my desk one day and he called another partner and said, yo, we got to go to Vegas. I just came back and I got to tell you how I got this woman to give me the best blowjob of my life.
Stop it, Tashira.
I'm not there. This is on speakerphone.
Stop it. I know the story, but I don't know this story.
This is on speakerphone. My desk is in like a open area.
Green vomit emoji.
Exactly. This is what they're talking about at
work.
At work. So it got to a point where I have to go to this same partner
person
and say, can you stop doing X, Y, and Z? I don't like it when you do that. Like, I don't like it. And I remember my ex being like, you've got to tell him to stop doing these things. And I remember even like calling a judge that I knew and being like, I don't know what to do. Like, I feel like this is illegal, but do I file a complaint? What do I do? She wasn't helpful, unfortunately, but like, really? I was just a lost kid in my early 20s. And so I come home, I tell my mom, and I think my mom really felt like I was being influenced by my ex, right? But it was really my experience. Whether or not he was giving me good or bad advice, it does not matter. It was my experience. And so I'm explaining to her what's happening. And she says to me, that's just what it means to go to work. Get over it. And maybe about a month later, I was at work and I got in my car on my lunch break and I drove home and I never went back. And I remember writing another, like the more senior partner, a long email kind of explaining my situation. And he was like, you know, please come back to work. And I was like, I'm not. This is what has happened to me. This is my experience. And that was that. So, yeah.
I'm so sorry that you experienced that. And I think that, you know, I think that if you've never experienced sexual harassment or fear of being harmed by someone, you don't quite understand that, like, you can't work in that environment. Like, even if they promise.
Yeah. Because it was a culture that was pretty despicable. I mean, imagine if someone feels comfortable talking openly on speakerphone about
a blowjob
at work, then imagine what the culture and what the environment has to be like.
Right.
So, you know, it's taken time and maturity for me to understand that our parents, my mom in particular, has only ever given me advice from the perspective of what she knows. And it saddens me to think about everything that she's had to have experienced. Like, my mom's story is that she was kind of one of the first, like, affirmative action hires in some ways at her company. This insurance company basically had these internships to bring in minority students. And she started as an intern, graduated from college, worked there. That's been her only job for the most part her entire life. And she had a child. I was born when she was 17 years old. She had parents who were very working class. She saw her responsibility, and she has done this to, like, get us out of poverty. And so she's had to face all types of, like, I can only imagine, harrowing circumstances. And so her advice to me was from that perspective.
So sorry for you, and I'm so sorry for your mom.
Yeah.
My mom also has had to endure a lot of harrowing, particularly circumstances related to sexual harassment. Mm. And it's...
And what about you for your 20s? Best or worst advice?
So I think I think the worst advice I got, whether it was explicit or implicit, was so this is going to be of no surprise to you, but, like, questioning the status quo was the wrong approach.
Mm.
And so, you know, that, like, I am, like, a pretty inquisitive person, and I, like, want to learn, and I want to, like, figure out what's going on and, like, why things are the way they are, or why we've come to where we are, and, like, what are the pros and what are the cons. And I think inherently I always had that in me. Like, I didn't understand law school. Like, I didn't understand why it was so terrible.
Right?
Or that it was supposed to be scary. Or that, you know, you were supposed to, like, first clerk for someone and then go to a firm. And then I've always questioned, like, questioning and being inquisitive and being seeking is, like, part of who I am.
Yeah.
And I think it's been both my blessing and my curse, like, because I've never really been part of a community, because I'm always a little, like, I like you, but I don't want to be part of you, or I don't know. I don't want to, like, fully throw myself into this cult, but I'm interested, right? And I think I approached my 20s that way, too. I had a really terrible breakup early in my 20s that I precipitated, but it was – and I was just questioning a lot. Like, do I really want to get married? Do I really want to have this life? Do I really want to live with this person? And people questioned why I did that. And then – when I was in law school, I was deeply unhappy. I really didn't like it. And so I was always questioning, like, is this the right path for me? Is this, why are we asking people everything? I was always wondering why the social expectations were placed on us when they were placed on us, and why.
Yeah.
And I think people close to me, and I should talk to them about this, sometimes got frustrated with me that they were like, just do it, Margo.
Oh, they thought you were complaining?
Yeah, but I wasn't complaining. I was just, working hard has never been my issue. You know that.
Of course.
But it was more like, if I'm going to put myself into this thing, why?
And I wonder if people begin to get frustrated because they'd already drank the Kool-Aid. So they're like, bitch, just sip. Like, this is what we're doing over here. Sip the Kool-Aid. You're making it harder for yourself than you have to be.
And it was harder for myself. Yeah. I mean, I did make it harder for myself in a lot of different ways. But I think that if that part of my brain and my soul had been nurtured more, I would have been more confident. Because I always felt like I was just like stupid and dumb and like, why couldn't I just like get it together like everyone else?
Gotcha. And the gag is they didn't have it together either.
No.
And I think we understand that more at a big age.
Totally.
Nobody knows what the fuck they're doing. Mm-mm. We're all confused. We're all trying to figure it out.
It's just living and figuring it out and surviving in whatever way we can with as much joy as we can, with as much love and presence as we can. But I think at the time I was like really searching outwardly for that. And I never felt like I could hang.
Well, let me just say that I'm also happy that a cult didn't appear because, I mean, you would have been prime for the picking, girl.
I don't know. I mean, I think I would be too skeptical.
Oh, I had my cult days.
I know you did.
Yeah.
I think that a cult would have been good for me in some ways.
What?
Not like an abusive cult.
Okay.
So cults are inherently abusive, so I should restate that. I think that there are going to be a lot of people in my life who are going to be like, Margo, stop. But I should never have become a lawyer. And I never really wanted to be a lawyer.
Mm-hmm. Me too.
But so unlike you, everyone who was close to me was a lawyer. I wanted to be a social worker. And I was steered towards law school. A very specific law school, but like still law school. And yeah. I wasn't ready to be in law school. I didn't do particularly well in law school. My brain is not the right brain for, I mean, I'm a good arguer.
I mean, you're a great advocate.
And I'm a good advocate, but I'm like, yeah, that citation, blah, blah, blah. Like you can figure it out with the URL link, right? Or like, why do you have to say id ipsis, blah, blah, blah? Like, just say the book and the page number.
And for folks who don't know, law school has very little to do with being an attorney.
But it's also like, I just have never been willing to play the game.
Yeah. Good for you.
And I think maybe you're the same.
Oh, absolutely.
I just like don't.
No, it's funny because I was telling someone recently, and I think the same thing is true about law school, and like this goes back to your like constant like inquiry, is that I'm a shit employee. And I didn't realize that until I was no longer an employee. I'm not good at playing the game. And as a matter of fact, once I realize what the game is, I'm slightly manipulative. Because
no, you're not.
No, but listen, hear me out. This is my moment of truth and self-awareness. I can say this honestly. And I would say to any of my bosses that I ever displayed this behavior to, I now am aware of it. I don't know if I apologize to you, but I'm now aware of it. That
there was one boss that Tashira sent an article when she quit.
I think that I'm pretty intelligent.
Very intelligent.
And I'm pretty socially agile. And so what I can do is figure out how to be really good at my job and then break every other rule. I don't have to get there on time. I don't have to check all the boxes because I perform so well. I'm an effective communicator. My acumen is so high until what can you do? It's hard for you to really check me. And then in certain environments, I get all of my colleagues to bang with me real tough, right? So then what you really gonna do? Because everybody's gonna ride with me and not with you.
Because people like you.
Because people like me, right? So it's like this double-edged sword that makes me a not so good employee. And I understand that about myself now. Thank God I am a solopreneur.
I love that for you.
Thank you.
Okay. Okay, 30s.
In my 30s, this is the best advice. Randomly, this is how God works, man. I opened up my townhome that I was renting, by the way, got into a lot of trouble behind this, for Airbnb.
I remember this.
Trying to make some extra income. And I had this person that
remember this too
showed up one day and changed my life. She is an angel. And so it turns out that this woman is a motivational speaker and a business coach and a leadership coach. And she was coming in town, like doing some work for certain county organizations. And, you know, you just strike up a conversation with folks. What do you do? Where are you from? Black queer woman, me and my ex were living together at that time. So, of course, we're actually having conversation. I end up telling her who I am. And at that time, I was really toying with like getting a PhD and talking about all this academic stuff that I wanted to do and who I was and a lawyer and policy and da-da-da-da. And she's like, yeah. But I don't think that's what you really want to do. And she was the only person that had questioned that. And she said, what I really think you want to do is build your brand. Because you're talking about, with a lot of excitement, the things that you've done and having this online presence and, you know, fashion and all these things. She said, I think that's what you want to do. And it scared the shit out of me that, number one, someone kind of saw me. Like, I felt so vulnerable. But it also was a relief because I was like, maybe I can do it. Maybe I should give myself permission to dream.
And now we have a celebrity.
And now we have politics and fashion.
And if anyone has seen those photos in Greece, you know what I'm talking. Shout out to Jasher Bloom.
Thank you, friend. And shout out to the photographer.
Wasn't she the photographer?
Yeah, she was.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, worst advice.
Worst advice in my 30s. It's probably nothing. When I found the lump in my breast. It's probably nothing. I was going to a new doctor. They were all, for the most part, telehealth. It was kind of before that has become wildly popular now. But they were the first ones. They had an app, all this stuff. And I remember making an appointment online with my nurse practitioner because that was kind of like their first line of support or healthcare services. And she was like, oh, you're fine. It's probably nothing. And then it turned out to be breast cancer.
Did you insist?
Yeah, I had to. So from the point where I found the lump, it was over the summer, to diagnosis was probably about a month and a half. And it was because I was following up.
That's terrible. And yeah. I wonder if that's changing.
I hope so.
As cancer rates are rising with young women.
And we also know from our former guests and having so many conversations about breast cancer on this platform that that story is not unique.
No.
So many people.
For all of our guests. Mm-hmm. I mean, Judith, Vera, Julie, you.
Downplayed.
And mine too. I mean, I didn't have cancer, but I had issues that I had been advocating for years. And they kept saying it was nothing. And then in the middle of the surgery is a big fucking deal.
Yeah, exactly. And so, yeah, that was the worst advice. And I'm so grateful that I followed up.
I'm so grateful you did too.
Thank you, friend. What about you?
Okay, so the best advice I got in my 30s, which was amazing advice, which was from my mom, actually, was that there's never the right time to do anything. Mm-hmm. And I appreciate this advice so much because I have never really, I mean, like in many ways, I've done things in a, kind of a very formulaic way. I think it's that out from the outside, people could say, but among things that were happening in our life, I think a lot of people questioned why Josh and I, for example, had Ella so young. I'm not so young, so early in our marriage, that I was really in a, we were in a pretty tenuous spot. We were living in two different states. I had a very temporary fellowship. I didn't know if I was going to have a full-time job. And I was just so called to have a baby. And I just like knew, and I was worried about fertility issues for some issues that had kind of spanned generations in my family. And I just knew that it was something that I needed. And I did it. And it wasn't the right time. Like, we weren't stable in the classic ways. We didn't have a stable home. I mean, we had a stable home because we loved each other and we loved her so much. But we were between two states. We were in an apartment that wasn't our primary home, right? Like, there was a lot of things. Like, I had a temporary job. Josh was had a job in a different state. But we had her. And I think if I hadn't heard that advice growing up, I think I would have not had my child. Mm-hmm. And there were other things similar to that. Like, I wouldn't have taken my job. There are lots of things that I've done with that advice that my mom has given me over the years, that knowing that there's never a right time for anything and that the things that you love the most are often the hardest things logistically. She always shared that with me.
Oh, that's deep. Come on, Ms. Laney.
Yeah.
The word.
So I was given a lot of bad advice in my 30s, I think, or internalized a lot of bad advice, but it all kind of has similar themes around that outward achievements are what it takes to be whole.
That goes back to your teens, yeah.
Right. And also kind of this goes along those lines. So that you can kind of control things. Like it's all within your control. And I think one of the things that I learned in my 30s that, and similar to kind of your diagnosis, right, is that it's not really, nothing is in your control. Mm-mm. And you can't control anything. And I wish that I hadn't felt so ashamed for some of the challenges that I had in my 30s because I felt like I was always doing something wrong. So I think there's some context I can give, but I've always struggled a lot with anxiety and I always thought it was like something I was doing, right? So I wasn't eating well enough. I wasn't exercising enough. And like my anxiety presents mostly in not being able to sleep. So there were so many lengthy, lengthy periods in my 30s, like months where I wouldn't sleep.
Like how much sleep were you getting?
Like I would get like 3 hours a night.
Are you serious, Margo?
Yeah. And so, yeah. And so I like was willing myself to be well, right? Like I always thought it was something I was doing wrong. Like I wasn't like exercising enough. I wasn't eating well enough. I wasn't like deep enough in my gratitude. It wasn't like I wasn't working hard enough or I was working too much. I don't know. Like it was always something else that I wasn't doing. And then guys, it turns out I have generalized anxiety disorder.
Yeah.
Which is like a chemical imbalance in my brain.
Yeah.
Right. And it's not surprising, like mental health issues flow in my family, like in most, and my child has it as well. And turns out I can sleep when I'm on an SSRI.
Mm.
And it's not perfect, right? But yeah. I think I wish I had given myself the grace to be okay with that.
Yeah.
As opposed to thinking there was something I was doing wrong.
I think that's a word and a metaphor for so many of us about a number of things in our lives, right? It's just a reminder about the importance of grace. And sometimes the thing that we're trying to control is beyond our control.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, I think we're definitely going to do an episode, I hope, I'm advocating for it, on harm reduction and mental health, right? But there's this idea that I think maybe it's different with the Gen Zers, but like at least with our generation that we're I feel like a lot of shame still.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's still a lot of shame. And I have been trying to open up about this a lot.
I know, Margo. You have.
I've written about it in my newsletters and I got such kind responses from people. And I followed up in another newsletter and I said, hey, y'all, here's what I'm doing now. I'm working on a wellness plan. I'm seeing my therapist just to take people on a journey with me around a very similar issue around anxiety, because I don't think that we talk about it enough. And I mean, this is also part of kind of that older generational message that was fed to us. And we're straddling about this idea that you don't overshare, but you share just enough.
Right. And I feel like even like sharing this, like my parents are going to be so disappointed in me. Right. But this kind of, right, this thing, right, that yeah. like sharing brings people in. Yeah. And I still like, I think you and I have shared about this too. And I think people like, I was sharing this actually with my therapist, like that a lot of people in my family are like, oh, that's just Margo, right? Like she always asks for help, right? So what? So I have a therapist. Josh and I have a therapist. Mm-hmm. My parents and my brother and I are in periodic therapy because we can't seem to figure out how to move through this phase together, mm-hmm. right? I have a psychiatrist, right? I am going to post-surgery PT. By the way, all of this is covered by my insurance. So I also want to just say that I have a private PPO plan through my partner's work. So. But it's not like I'm indiscriminately like throwing money at something.
Yeah.
Which I'm not judging people who do that. But I ask for help. Mm-hmm. But then I feel ashamed about it.
Mm-hmm.
So like I'm farther along than maybe the baby boomers, but I'm not where the Gen Zers are.
Yeah, I was about to say that's still like straddling like I know these I need generations.
Help, right? And I know I need help and I'm not I want to be filled with joy.
Yeah.
And I want to be able to share that with my kids. Oh, also, I should say that my older children are in therapy as well.
Yeah.
Right. So it's something that like is very normalized in our home.
I love it.
And it is very helpful. I mean, incredibly helpful, but also something that I feel kind of like basic about.
Well, it's this duality that I think is so true. I mean, it goes back to this push to achieve and define success in a very specific way, the advice that we were given. Because I'm sitting there with my therapist. I could probably therapize myself to some degree.
Totally, we both could. We've been in therapy enough.
For so long. So I'm acutely aware of the fact that I am a workaholic.
Correct.
That I have a scarcity mindset.
Correct, me too.
Right? That I need to put parameters around work. I'm sitting there telling her every single issue with so much clarity. But the problem is that I'm not willing to implement the solutions, Margot, because of the prior generational mindset that I've been conditioned into, which is that you just gotta fucking work hard. Put your nose to the ground and just do it. Why are you complaining? Back to you being inquisitive. Why are you complaining? Just get it done. Something good always comes from hard work. You will receive the reward, oftentimes by way of financial compensation, because that's the only award that is worth receiving anyway. So just keep working. Meanwhile, I'm having major anxiety attacks. I'm suffering from suicidal ideations. Sorry, trigger warning I should have given. I'm fucking struggling with my mental health, but my mind is telling me to just keep working.
I saw this, I don't know, it's not a meme, but like this thing on social media. And it was posted by someone in our generation that was like, growing up, I saw either in my own community or in the public sphere, like example, and I think this goes to your point, of like, badass women, gritty women, hardworking women, successful women, women who've come up from nothing, women who've like broken barriers and boundaries and had babies and like nursed and like blah, 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 and like are in the C-suite and are running soccer games and are like running a household and like all the things. I never once saw a relaxed woman.
Mm. Come on.
And I think about that a lot because I also we both need to think about that a lot as people who've been impacted by cancer.
Yeah.
Right. And right, inflammation and stress and sleep are all so inflammation bad, sleep good, relaxation good, movement good, eating well good, right? Being in community, important. And we all want to live different lives, right? So I'm not saying that we're a monolith, but I think a lot of us could say that we want to live well and live long and live healthy and joyful. Mm-hmm. And you know where you're not going to get that from?
Working yourself to the bone.
And so what do we do? Like, that's all we've been told.
It's impossible.
And so I think that I don't necessarily think Tashara and myself are like good examples of this at all.
Yeah.
But I think that we want to keep talking about this because like, what does it mean to be in relaxation? And that could look different for all of us.
I haven't thought about this. I've been thinking about this more and more lately, especially as it relates to internet trolls.
Oh.
And people kind of being very tightly wound up and having something to say. I think it's a lack of good dick. I think it's pervasive, dog. I think there's something going on in the world. There is a lack of good sexual intercourse that is happening. I'm being flippant, but I'm also being very sincere here. I think that there is something about seeking pleasure that we are not doing enough of. And that would solve a lot of this overwork that we're talking about.
And pleasure could
be a number of things. It could be a number of things. I'm using sex as the example.
By the way, Tashara doesn't like penises.
I don't. But I've come to use good dick, as a metaphor for good sex. Because it, just because I don't like penises does not mean that penises are not present in my relationship.
Do you know what Cheshire wants? Good anal.
It's a lack of good anal in the world. It's a lack of
good anal in the world. Wait, but I think there's something here.
Yeah, I'm trying to.
And I think that we have very monolithic, maybe I've used monolith too much, this, like very specific ways of describing what pleasure is.
Mm-hmm.
Being sex in a particular way, being socializing in a particular way. But what if it was something that and more? Right? Maybe it's I'm just saying something like out of the blue, like lying on the couch with your partner, like cuddled up, reading together.
Oh, that, and that's intimacy, by the way, as well. That sounds right. Beautiful to me.
Right. So like one of the things that Josh has done for me over the years, which I think is like one of the sweetest, most special things in our relationship. I actually can't believe I'm sharing this, but I think it is important to share. Is that when I, as I've shared, I've struggled with insomnia, and he often reads an article to me so that I can fall asleep. Mm-hmm. And we're in bed together and we're cuddling and he's reading to me and I fall asleep.
That's partnership.
That's right. Beautiful. And he like waits till he knows like when I'm fast asleep and then he finishes the article, which is annoying because then I don't get the article. But again, like I think that there's a lot of different ways to describe pleasure that maybe we never...
Well, it goes back to the example of the relaxed woman. We also never saw a woman experiencing pleasure.
Right.
Yeah. Or joy outright.
So the closest thing I ever got was my grandma, Marion. But so much of her relaxation was revolved around my grandpa.
What do you mean?
Him being relaxed.
Oh, that's interesting.
So like her providing space for him to relax was relaxing to her.
And by the way, your grandma also worked and had a very important job.
Right, she worked. She worked, but she was on the academic schedule, so she was a college counselor. Oh, she did a lot of things, but like her last career was as a college counselor. My grandpa was a lawyer, but like I remember her in the summers being more relaxed, and so I spent summers with her sometimes, and but it was often like we called my grandpa Bubba, like. Well, Bubba's playing golf, so he's in a good space. Or Bubba's, like, napping, so I'm happy. So it was very, like, my grandpa was a total workaholic.
So, like, the person that she was caring for and putting his needs before hers, if he was good, then she could also give herself space to relax and be right. Good.
So that also feels...
Yeah, but it's a narrative that is far... to present. Okay, let's get to 40s where we are now.
I'm so interested. I don't know what you're going to say.
I don't have any worst advice. Let me tell you that because I don't fucking listen. I couldn't give two fucks. I ain't got to give. I don't. It doesn't mean that I don't love people and I don't recognize that people who care about me might have an opinion. But I think unless I ask to you for it, you could keep it to yourself because very little of it is going to kind of permeate, right? The sphere that I have built around myself. So I think the best advice as of late came from you.
What?
Well, we had a conversation about my workaholism, remember?
I do remember that.
And you sat me down the last time I came to film and you were like, something is wrong with this picture. And I knew something was off, but I couldn't really put my finger on it because, again, I'm just fighting this narrative in my mind of just work hard. And it was you who helped me to articulate, not only is this problematic, but we have to think about ways to solve it. And so I'm grateful for you, Em, because you gave me this kind of peace that I needed to redefine success.
Well, thank you. I did not know that was from me, but I do remember that conversation, obviously. Okay, so I actually feel similarly about the worst advice. I don't listen to it anymore. I think I got a lot of advice about not quitting my job, not going into business for myself. But you know what? Like, I needed to do what was right for me. Yeah. And I... think that if I had listened to people, my life would have looked really different and it wouldn't be as beautiful and joyful and filled as it is right now. So I don't listen to the negative so much. I think the best advice, though, that I have gotten, I don't know who it's from. I mean, part of it's from you for sure, but I think part of it is a messaging that I have internalized as well, that we only have one life.
Period.
And so I'm going to live it. And I think that's come with a lot of negative feedback from my, you know, we've talked about that, right? And so I'm doing things a little bit differently. And I'm present in ways for my family that I never was before, but I'm also away from my family in ways that I've never been before. And it's working really well.
Amen.
So I'm really grateful for you. I think one of the ways that I would like to end this episode, if we can, is a message that you shared with me and a lot of people. I'm not like unique to this, that you shared it with a lot of people, not just with me, but maybe like 10 years ago, 11 years ago, about joy as an act of resistance.
Mm-hmm. And that is rooted in the philosophy by Audre Lorde.
Yes, you know? Absolutely. But how you showed so many of us the way.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, friend.
And just that, like, particularly now, like, this episode is going to air in November of 2023. There's so much darkness in the world and loss and tension. And being joyful doesn't mean you don't see that.
Amen.
But it's also, like, today's only today.
Today's only today, and to harken back to your point, we only have one life to live. And while my sadness and my pain has not been unique, I posted something today talking about how before I was 40, I'd had a partial hysterectomy, so become infertile, and I had gone through breast cancer. And so if you see me being joyful today, it's because I fought through the shadows, right? So I don't think that my suffering is unique, but what I do think there is a message around is how we heal beyond the pain and how we create a life for ourselves. And I hope that is what has come across in this episode.
Absolutely.
Love you, friend.
Love you, friend.
We'll see y'all next time.